You're listening to Sipping on Some Crime podcast, hosted by Aaron. This podcast covers sensitive and triggering subjects, explicit language, and mature content which may not be suitable for children. As always, all parties are innocent until proven guilty.
Today, I will be covering the Tracy Crow case. Tracy, just 17, disappeared after leaving her home to drop off items at her sister's house before heading to the town square to hang out with friends. The following day, Tracy's car would be found in the local town square, but Tracy was nowhere to be found. What happened that night in that small town? And how has Tracy's case remained unsolved for 33 years? Tracy was born on April 9, 1972, and was one of three daughters of parents Ivan and Ellen Crow. Tracy would grow up in the area of Millersburg, Pennsylvania, a small town with a population in the 90s just above 2,000 residents. It's a small, tight-knit community just 25 minutes from the state capital and is known as a railroad and river town. Millersburg sits along the Susquehanna River and has stunning views of open waterways surrounded by flush greenery. Millersburg is also home to the only wooden double-stern paddle wood ferry in the United States. They can load 3 to 4 cars on the wooden ferry, and you can enjoy the 25-minute ride from Millersburg to Liverpool. It's something that makes their tiny town tucked away in Pennsylvania stand out from the rest. There's a town square that's lined with mom-and-pop shops, and in the middle, a grassy park area with cobblestone sidewalks that lead to a gazebo that the town decorates for every holiday and special town event. It's the type of town where you know your neighbors and you spend time catching up with others Saturday morning at the locals' farmer market on Main Street. Tracy was known as a studious kid who was very focused on her schooling and took part in many extracurricular activities to include yearbook editor, member of the Future Business Leaders of America, contributed art to the school newspaper, as well as was on the Honor Society. Tracy was well liked by her peers as she was in so many activities in school, and that allowed her to interact with many different social groups. Tracy was hyper-focused on her future, especially as she would be heading into her senior year that fall at Halifax High School. Teachers described Tracy as a quiet student that was extremely hardworking. Superintendent Wayne Boyer would say, quote, "She has an excellent sense of humor. I could throw a joke out and she'll enjoy it. She's in the top 25%, maybe 10% of her class, and has made many friends at her small school where there's a good camaraderie among students," unquote. Tracy was looking for a job that summer, but wasn't able to find anything, so she was home and around a lot that summer, as other friends were working. Friends and family said that she had a close group of friends she often hung out with, a steady boyfriend, and was focusing on colleges to attend after senior year that would help her line up a good job in the future. She had huge ambitions and was working really hard to accomplish them. Tracy grew up in the middle between two sisters, her younger sister at this time, who was 12, Kimberly, and her older sister, Tammy, who was 20, married, and living away from home. On the evening of August 5th, 1989, Tracy would decide to hop in her car and drop off a barbecue that they had borrowed from Tammy and her husband, and some grocery coupons for Tammy before going to hang out with friends. Tracy would arrive 10 p.m. at Alex Acres Trailer Park in Halifax off Route 147, about 7 miles from her house. This is another area of small towns that are really close together, and for those that have lived in areas like this, you know that while your town is separate from all those other little ones, you still frequently find yourself in those other close towns multiple times throughout the day or week because each little town has something different that brings you there, like work or school, a doctor's appointment, etc. And it's just the way these little towns in the country on the East Coast are built. So I put on my website a picture of how close these towns are together and how Route 147 kind of runs between all of them. Just for those that like a really good visual representation of the geography, I know some people don't care about the geography or the place that these victims have grown up, but I think it's important to understand the towns, the culture, and the geography of each case because it's an important part of each victim's story. Tracy would leave the barbecue and coupons on her sister's doorstep since when she arrived, no one was home. Tracy would then head out to see friends in Millersburg Square, where most of the local teenagers hung out. Here's honestly again where we aren't sure exactly what Tracy's plans were, but there were two main things said from the very beginning in the papers by friends and by witnesses. Some say Tracy was headed to Millersburg Square to hang out with friends, and other reports state they believe she was heading to Millersburg to see her boyfriend. Either way, everyone agrees that Tracy headed to Millersburg after leaving her sister's house in Halifax. That night, there would be sightings of Tracy on a payphone, sitting down by the river, sightings of her at Town Square, sitting on steps of a local shop located across from Town Square. Tracy's mother, Ellen, would wake up at 2 a.m. realizing Tracy wasn't home, but assumed she had stayed at Tammy's for the night. This was something she had done before. Ellen went back to sleep, and the following day, as her and Ivan awaited Tracy's return, they began to worry. Ellen would call Tammy's house to see if Tracy had stayed the night, and if so, when she was planning to come home. When Tammy informed her parents that Tracy wasn't there, they began reaching out to Tracy's other friends. It was getting closer to evening now, and still, no one knew where Tracy was. Ivan would decide to head to Millersburg Town Square to look for Tammy, and Ellen would phone police to report her missing. When Ivan arrived to the town square, he would spot Tracy's 1971 white Mercury Comet with two blue stripes down the side. It was parked outside a local store in the square and locked, but her belongings were not in the car. When investigators sat down with Ivan and Ellen, Ellen made it clear that Tracy had not run away. That this was a good kid who didn't drink or use drugs and had left her savings book at home that had $300 in the checking account as well as $400 in savings. She also had $8 in cash in her room in her cupboard. When she left the house the night before, there was nothing unusual about her behavior and she only had a small purse with her, nothing that would allude to her not returning home. Investigators started by interviewing friends and locals that were at the town square that night, and was able to confirm that Tracy was in the town square that night, but nobody knew where she went from there. Ivan decided to take his vacation time from work and look for her himself. Ellen stayed home answering the phone and with every ring hoping it was Tracy. Ellen said in those first few weeks the phone didn't stop ringing. She said so many people called in to tell her where they thought Tracy could be, or rumors they'd heard about Tracy. They wanted to let the family know they were looking for her, or other callers wanted to let her know that they were just sorry to hear that Tracy was missing. The phone literally didn't stop ringing for quite a few weeks, but unfortunately, none of those calls were Tracy. Ellen said it got really bad for a while. People were calling their home with very descriptive, terrifying rumors of what happened to Tracy that night. Ellen said the rumors just got out of hand. All of a sudden, everybody in town was talking about how Tracy's disappearance had to do with some cult. They would even go out of their way to call her house to tell her these things. Ellen reminded the community that if you have something to say about Tracy, any clue where she might be, she wants to hear it. But wasting time with these horrific rumors and her family having to hear them, she wondered what they were all thinking when they would say and do these things. In September, just a month later, Ellen would tell the papers that in the beginning, they really did believe that someone took Tracy, and now they're just trying to search for the where. She said so many things run through your mind about your child who's missing, like, is she being fed? Is she being drugged? Is she tied up somewhere? Can she not get away? All those awful things keep running through your mind. Ivan at the time worked for the Pennsylvania Turnpike System, and his fellow employees would copy Tracy's flyer with her high school yearbook picture and description of her, and they would plaster copies of the flyer all along the 400-plus mile turnpike, asking thousands of daily drivers if they recognized her face. They would also offer up a $5,000 reward for any information leading to the whereabouts of Tracy. Crime Stoppers would go on to offer an additional $1,000 on top of that reward. Large signs around 4 feet tall would be put all over town and the surrounding areas with Tracy's face and description to include one right outside of the gazebo in the same place that she had vanished. Metal Industries Plastic, a local company, would join the search for Tracy as well as donating $250 to go towards signs that could be placed around Halifax with Tracy's picture and information on it. State and local police would join forces in the search for Tracy. But days began to turn into weeks, and weeks began to turn into months, with no leads pointing either local or state police in any direction as to what happened to Tracy. Ellen would tell Pottsville Republican that she was very frustrated with the investigation and the fact that her daughter was still not home. Ellen would tell reporter David Carroll, quote, "It's been going on for 3 months now. To me, it's like a dead end. Hope, it's the only thing I have left anymore," unquote. Ellen said that at this time, the state police, as well as detectives from Harrisburg Police Department, were working on investigating Tracy's case, but that she didn't have any new information or updates to share. Ellen said, quote, "Apparently, there is nothing to update, unfortunately. There might be things that they are looking into, but they can't say, even to me," unquote. Ellen was very open early on in the investigation about the fact that she believed that there were those in the community that knew something about what happened to Tracy. Ellen would tell reporter Vicki Terry Wiggler in the Pottsville Republican on September 1989, quote, "I know there's somebody that probably knows where she is, and someone's holding something back one way or another. How can someone in Millersburg disappear without someone seeing something? Maybe it happened. I don't know. I still have the feeling somebody knows something and they're just afraid to say it. And then again, they may say I don't want to get involved," unquote. Ellen would go on to say that even at this point with the investigation feeling completely stalled, they're not going to stop looking for Tracy. And that this has brought her closer to her other daughters, Tammy and Kimberly. Despite local and state police forces and community involvement in the searches for Tracy and how many companies came forward to help and how many people in the community came forward to help as well, still, there isn't anybody coming forward to say that they saw anything. And Tracy's family and some locals really struggle with that because of how small their community is. Investigators would spend some time focusing on Tracy's boyfriend and his family, asking if they had something to do with her disappearance and if his family had helped him cover it up. Her boyfriend was, by all accounts, very cooperative with the investigation as well as his family. And eventually, they were all cleared of any involvement in Tracy's disappearance. In 1993, Tracy's driver's license and Honor Society card would wash up on the banks of Wiconisco Creek, approximately 10 miles from Millersburg. Investigators, of course, would search that area and that creek looking for more traces of Tracy and her belongings, but nothing else would be found in that area. It would be in 1994 that Tracy's case would gain some national attention, putting the spotlight back on Tracy's case not just locally. An anonymous tipster would tell investigators in Pennsylvania that they had seen Tracy alive, being held captive by a man named Thomas Stewart and an older woman who was also had two other missing girls in the same hotel in Austin, Texas, and that all three girls were being forced into sex work. The tipster said that these captors were traveling with the girls in two vans. One was a white van with a Florida tag, and the other was a bluish-gray van with an unknown tag. This tip that Pennsylvania received would be sent to all law enforcement agencies across the country via the computer system, and that tip would be made public when it was never supposed to. The tipster told investigators that those three girls were Tiffany Sessions, Tracy Crow, and Beth Ann Miller. Tiffany Sessions was a well-known case, but Tracy and Beth Ann were not, and investigators questioned how they knew about them. The tipster also had shared some details in the Beth Ann Miller's disappearance that the public didn't know. The same year that Tracy disappeared, Tiffany Sessions would also vanish, and Tiffany's case would get national attention right away. Tiffany, who was a junior at the University of Florida, would tell her roommate on February 9th, 1989, that she was going for a run. This was something that Tiffany had done many times before. It was around 6 p.m. and Tiffany took her typical route, leaving her off-campus apartment in Gainesville and traveling down Williston Road. Tiffany left behind her keys, her identification, and her wallet in her apartment. So there was nothing indicating that she had not planned to return after her walk or run like she usually did. When Tiffany didn't return that night, her roommate called Tiffany's mother and let her know that she was concerned that Tiffany had yet to arrive back home. Tiffany's mother would call her father, and they would report their daughter missing that night. Tiffany came from a wealthy family, and they used their resources to search for Tiffany, like her father chartering a helicopter to look for her, or having NFL players at press conferences talking to the public to help them in their search and sharing Tiffany's image and description with millions of viewers. Tiffany's case garnered lots of attention, and it brought in many tips, but is still unsolved today. The other young girl the tipster claimed to have seen was Beth Ann Miller, 14, from Idaho Springs, Colorado. Beth was a freshman on the basketball team and often jogged to stay in shape for her games. August 16, 1983, Beth would leave her home to go jogging just like any other day. And just like Tiffany, Beth would leave all her personal belongings at home when she left. Her family stated if Beth had any other plans after her jog, she would typically leave a note for her parents, but this day she did not, so they expected her home after her run. When she didn't return, her parents reported her missing. Investigators would begin the search right away, and when they would speak to witnesses, they say that they last saw Beth jogging by the park that she often jogged past, but no one saw her after that. One of Beth's siblings would come forward telling investigators that they had seen Beth at the park a few days earlier, and she was talking with a man in a red pickup truck with a brown stripe on the side and a white camper shell with out-of-state plates. They said this man was flirting with Beth, and when she ignored his advances, he became angry. Investigators believe this may be connected to her disappearance, and to this day, her case remains unsolved, but investigators do have two suspects that they believe could be linked to Beth's disappearance. So how did this tipster know all three of these girls were missing, and knew facts about each girl's case? Tiffany, they could see, but all three girls? When there wasn't Google and the internet was in its infancy, that really caught investigators' attention. All three families would be given some hope that their daughters could be found. The Gainesville Sheriff's Office would release a statement saying that they and other agencies have been researching this tip for over 3 weeks, and they were yet to be able to verify anything the tipster had reported. Lieutenant Emery Ganey of the Gainesville Department at the time said, quote, "Our position is to err on the side of caution. We're going to run down anything," unquote. Harold Foster, who at the time was the agent in charge of the Colorado Bureau of Investigation, working on Beth's case, said, "The tip was hard to believe." Foster said, quote, "The consensus is that the person was not being entirely truthful. When you consider the scope and volume of flyers sent out in these cases, with the propensity for such an act, could pick up that information very easily," unquote. This lead would be thoroughly investigated by all parties to include the FBI, and unfortunately, this lead did not bring any of these girls home. I will be adding links to Tiffany Sessions' case as well as Beth Ann Miller's case for anybody interested in taking a deeper dive into those cases. In 1999, the 10-year anniversary of Tracy's disappearance, her family would come out to the local press reminding everyone that they were still looking for Tracy, that they hadn't given up. In fact, her younger sister Kim would write an open letter to her sister in the local paper. She wrote, "I know 10 years have gone by, but I want you to know that I haven't given up hope. I would give anything to have my daughters grow up knowing who their Aunt Tracy is and not growing up looking at pictures with questions I cannot answer." Unquote. An age progressed photo would also be released at this time. I'll, of course, add that on my website at sippingonsomecrime.com and put the link to the photo in the show notes as well. Investigators continue working on Tracy's case, and with new investigators and them looking at new directions that they could take, they again look at the boyfriend and his family in 2002, and even search a property that was owned by the family with cadaver dogs, but nothing was found. Again, investigators would clear Tracy's boyfriend and his family with any involvement in Tracy's case. At this point, investigators had determined that their official theory was that Tracy had been abducted that night in Millersburg Town Square and was murdered somewhere northern Dauphin County. In 2016, an anonymous tip would lead investigators to a property along Middle Road just a quarter mile from Alex Acres Trailer Park. This property was once owned by Matthew Webster, and investigators now had a warrant to search that property. Matthew Webster did know Tracy's father and the family in the 80s, and his property was known as the party spot for all the young people to get together and hang out back then. Investigators would arrive with cadaver dogs and spend a few days searching the property and find nothing. But that didn't stop them from coming back to this property multiple times in 2016 and the years moving forward. Investigators strongly believe that this property, Matthew, or both, had something to do with Tracy's disappearance, despite their searches not providing them with the answers they were looking for. In 2018, a woman named Holly Mallett would come forward to investigators telling them that she had information on Tracy's case that she needed to share. Holly would tell investigators that during one of the searches of Matthew's old property, he was hanging out at her house and they were drinking and talking and reminiscing about the past, when Matthew would tell Holly that he knew what happened to Tracy that night.
"You don't understand, I have kids to worry about.
No one's going to
And he's already hurt one person. He's going to hurt me too.
No.
He was drinking. Over. He said to me that him and a couple of buddies were up at the square. And she happened to be up there. And they all wanted to have a good time. So it was supposed to be just a rape. And it was supposed to be done. But then it turned out to be a lot more than that. And that's all I know. Do you want to know what my opinion is?
Well,
my opinion is, from that conversation,
yes.
She's owned that property."
Mm-hmm. Okay. That's what you were led to believe based on the tone, from Matt.
Yeah.
Investigators would ask Holly if she was willing to testify to this in court, and she agreed. After the interview with Holly, investigators were able to get a wiretap on Matthew's phone. While investigators had this wiretap on Matthew's cellular phone, they were able to serve him with a subpoena for him to testify in front of a grand jury. Shortly after Matthew received this subpoena, him and Holly would speak on the phone about her testimony and his. In this recorded conversation, Matthew would tell Holly that he forgave her for going to investigators and that he would pay for her to have representation when she testified. Matthew and Holly would then also discuss how they were going to roll back her previous statements and what they were both going to say about it when they testified in front of the grand jury. Matthew would be in court for Holly's grand jury testimony and deny talking to her previously. Even with the recorded conversation in their hands, he continued to deny speaking to Holly before the grand jury testimony. Both Holly and Matthew would be charged with perjury, and each of them would go to court and be found guilty. Matthew would receive a sentence of 4 to 6 months in prison, but was granted time served and given 12 months of probation. Holly was sentenced 6 to 23 months in prison. And now that brings us to July 2019, when investigators would show up on a property owned by Mark Werfel on 100 block Mountain House Road in Jackson Township, just 10 miles from where Tracy was last seen, with excavation equipment and cadaver dogs. Mark once owned and ran an auto body shop on that property. At first, investigators wouldn't confirm that they were there for Tracy's case, but eventually they would come forward stating that they were searching Mark's property as part of an ongoing investigation into Tracy's disappearance. When local Fox 43 News showed up to interview Mark about the current search on his property, he said he wasn't concerned.
When I said, what are you digging for? They thought maybe the remains of Tracy Crow might be there. Well, I said, you can dig all you want, but you ain't gonna find nothing.
September 4th, 2019, Mark would be arrested for being accused of repeatedly threatening, harassing, and breaking into a woman's home in Halifax. He was charged with harassment and burglary and to this day is still awaiting trial. None of these charges have anything to do with Tracy's disappearance. Investigators would continue to go back to Mark's property in 2020 while also searching an additional property that he owned in 2020 as well. However, he has never been officially named as a suspect in Tracy's disappearance. Mark is still being held in custody, but in 2020, a psychologist deemed him not competent to stand trial for his current accusations of threatening, harassing, and burglarizing a woman in his community. That is slowing things down in his current case, and we don't know what that means moving forward in Tracy's investigation. Today, this is unfortunately where we sit with Tracy's case. It still remains unsolved. Her sister and her mother are still fighting to keep her name and story in the public and to bring her home. You can still find Tracy's flyer and a few billboards in Millersburg and surrounding towns because they are not giving up on bringing Tracy home. Tracy's community and family has not forgotten her. Tracy's father, Ivan, unfortunately passed away in 2008 without getting any answers about his daughter's disappearance and who is responsible. Ellen, Tammy, and Kim continue daily to find ways to fight for Tracy, and they truly believe that they will one day get the chance to bring her home and lie her to rest. At this point, it's the most important thing to their family is just getting to bring Tracy home. Please share Tracy's story in any format that you feel comfortable and help shine a light on Tracy's case and remind her family and the community that they're not alone in their search for Tracy and her justice. At the time of Tracy's disappearance, she was a Caucasian female at 17 years old. She has light brown curly hair, green eyes, and a small mole in the center of her chin. Tracy is 4'10", around 85 pounds. She was wearing a light blue and white floral print skirt and light blue and white shorts, both size small. She was wearing white sneakers that were the size 4.5 or 5 and a silver Timex watch that she always wore on her left wrist. She was also wearing a Halifax High School class of 1990 ring with a white diamond and carrying a small purse with a thin strap with either a horse or a unicorn on the side. Her keys for her car also had a Roger Rabbit keychain hanging from them. Anyone with information about Tracy's disappearance is urged to contact the Pennsylvania State Police at 717-362-8700 or 717-705-0340. Thank you so much for listening to another episode. And if you're listening on Apple or Spotify, if you could hit that subscribe button, leave a review, or do both, I would greatly appreciate it. That helps other listeners find this podcast and get these cases to more ears. Remember, when you see those missing and murdered posts on social media, to hit like, share, and retweet. Every time we share a face, we get closer to solving a case. Until next time.